Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Thursday, March the 13th, 2025, and this is episode 3,640 of the Survival Podcast. That's a kind of a little landmark sounding episode there. We'll be at 3,650 not so long in the future. My grandson pointed out to me earlier this week, he said, man, you're going to be at episode 3,700 really soon, or no, 4,000, I guess. And when he did the math and figured out how many episodes there are to a year, he goes, well, you're not that close yet, but we will get there. We will see episode 4,000 sometime in the not-too-distant future. But today we are focused on today, and it's an expert counsel show. Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams will talk about how Trump attacking Thomas Massie because he won't go along to get along with Trump's bullshit CR is really bad form. And here's the other thing. Trump is a petty little fuck at times. He really is. There's a lot of things that I like about what Trump's done, but he is a petty little fuck. And this is why I mean. The House bill, the CR that Massie voted against, passed. It's irrelevant that Massie voted against it, but Trump and the AIPAC lobby now want to get rid of Massie. I did something yesterday that I haven't done since the 90s. That's a while. That's pre-Survival Podcast, by quite a bit, actually. That's 8 years prior to the first episode of Survival Podcast, at least. And it's probably more like 12. It's probably mid-90s. I wrote a check. Well, I actually just made an electronic donation, but I effectively wrote a check to a politician, Thomas Massie. I'll say a little bit on that when we get there. Then Annie McCann will talk about standing desks and exercising while you're at your desk. I find this to be unnecessary for me. And often when I find something to be unnecessary for me, I make a huge mistake in that I don't talk about it enough. Because I'm like, exercise at your desk. I just, you know, every so often get up and go do something. And then come back to my desk. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Remember, Jack, when you lived in a cubicle and like you couldn't just go do things? Because then somebody would be like, what are you doing? And I went, yeah, that was a long time ago, but okay, yeah. And I do think that maybe there's some things we can do to make our life at our desk a little more productive in our lives. And Andy's got quite a bit on that today. Then Joel is continuing his four-part series, which is on, you know, moving with your dog on a lead this week, specifically a loose lead. So it's a four-part series. This is part three of four. Mike Melito will talk on a twofer for you about fixing broken stocks and 22 semi-automatics. Ryan Steva, the homestead consultant, will talk to you about home water filtration systems. Nicole Sauce will talk about making and using milk kefir. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about developing recipes that are disinflammatory. And he's not using that word, I am, and I'm gonna add on a little bit about his segment about the difference between like not eating things that actually cause inflammation. That's a good thing. But there are actually foods, and probably the best among them are red ruminant meats like beef, that are actually disinflammatory. In other words, they actually actively reduce inflammation. And one of the things he mentions, ginger, is also very disinflammatory as well. So we'll add on a little bit about that, which, since it's about your health, will fit really well into my anchor segment today. The Texas legislature is discussing through the SNAP program, making it where if you're a Texas, you're in Texas and you get SNAP for your kids' food, that you can't spend the SNAP credits on things like, well, sodas and potato chips and corn, basically junk food. And you'll never guess who immediately dispatched a lobbyist to argue against this at the State House in Austin. The American Heart Association. The American Heart Association is very concerned that if poor children are cut off of their access to large amounts of sugar-based foods that have very little nutritional value, that their nutritional life will suffer. And they also are making the claim that there is no link between obesity and other health problems and sugar consumption. Yeah, this doesn't make any sense. And it also has me pissed. This one, I mean, I see shit like this done all the time. I teach you guys pattern recognition all the time. And it always pisses me off. But this is kind of so in your face. And I actually have a short audio clip, a little little over a minute, like a minute 18 seconds, I'm going to play for you, of a woman advocating for this bill and a member of the American Heart Association, right, a consortium of physicians that are concerned with promoting cardiovascular health in America, explaining how important it is that we keep giving children corn chips, potato chips, and Coca-Cola and Pepsi products. This actually has me, I'm kind of using this segment today to tease a little bit an episode next week. I'm gonna do an episode next week called The True Enemies of the State. And as the list begins to form, it might need to be a series. Or not enemies of the state, enemies of the people, I'm sorry. The American Heart Association and other medical associations like the American Diabetes Association, I feel like they fall on that list, enemies of the people. There's other groups that fall in there, and there's an unholy alliance between them. I'm talking, of course, about Big Food as a whole. If you don't think the reason the American Heart Association wants your child drinking Coke is related to the food industry and the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industry, and it's not all a big cabal, then you're just not paying attention. So I'm going to talk today a little bit about this bill, and I'm going to prime you guys to help me for next week to send me ideas for who goes on the enemies list. Now, I want to be clear about that because I've put this out on social media. I'm getting some great feedback, and I'm getting some feedback. It's not bad. It's just not what I'm looking for. Like, Anthony Fauci. Okay, great. Yeah, sure. But Anthony Fauci falls under the federal bureaucracy and also falls under the healthcare industry. I'm looking for whole groups. And what I want that show to be is going to not just be about identifying the enemy, but identifying the solution. So here's an example right now that's not directly related to what I'm going to talk about today with sugar. When Trump got elected and RFK got brought in, before he was even confirmed as HHS secretary, and some of the movements that started, which in and of themselves are decent, like, hey, maybe we shouldn't be cooking all our food with seed oils anymore, some companies saw this as an opportunity. And I have no problem using capitalism to its strengths to encourage companies to do good things because they're in demand, like tallow fries, right? So this company called Steak and Shake, which if you think you're going to get healthy food at a place called Steak and Shake, you're already delulu, okay? But they came out and said, we're going to start frying all our fries 100% with tallow now. Well, lo and behold, it turns out that fries at Steak and Shake are actually battered. You do not need to batter a fry. And they're literally soaked and par-cooked in seed oils. But then when you go to Steak and Shake and order your garbage food, when they put the fries out of the freezer into the deep fryer to finish them and crisp them all up for you, they put them in tallow and they call them tallow fries. Folks, if you want tallow fries, as I said earlier this week, make your own. Make your own. So that would be the solution there. And so these enemies of the people are so ingrained in the system, there is no way to reform the system. We're going to have to create our own independent movements for all of these things. And identifying the enemy first would probably be a good thing. And the reason is this. If you are concerned about your health, and somebody that's in health is your enemy, then you probably shouldn't take their advice about your health. Even if they happen to be right, you'll probably figure out the parts they're right about on your own without them. They should be giving no credibility and no quarter whatsoever. So I'll be talking about that today as it relates to the American Heart Association, who's on my list of complete and total scum right next to the American Diabetes Association, which I believe has done more to harm diabetics than to help them, even though you're going to hear Chef Ken invoke them. And I'm going to have to talk to Chef Ken about not trusting these people because they cannot be trusted. Remember, the American Diabetes Association is part. Now, Ken says they don't have recipes on their site. Well, Ken's wrong. They do. You just have to know where to look. And it's a collaboration between the American Diabetes Association and a company called DaVita, who only profits by providing kidney dialysis, which diabetics end up needing in very large amounts. And I want you to think about, as we're having that whole conversation, this. I'm going to kind of prime it now, and then we'll end with it. Nobody that profits from a thing wants the thing that they profit from to go away. With that, let's start off with why Trump attacking Thomas Massie is truly bad form.
But anyway, he went after, once again, he went after a friend of ours who has earned respect and is probably the most straightforward person in the Congress, except for maybe somebody in the Senate. So, Thomas Massie earned the wrath of the president because he said, I don't think anybody's going to give me a lobotomy and erase all my memory before the vote comes up. But there's no way I could vote for this. And it wasn't hard to figure out why not. He happened to believe that you're supposed to follow your oath of office. It's no more complicated than that. What I'm annoyed about, and maybe Chris is too, is that why would they pick on this, especially that Trump has made overtures to the libertarian group of people in the Republican Party, because that group is silently growing and being instrumental, and that's reflected on a lot of what they are doing. There's no doubt about it. But the easiest thing to do to survive all that is exactly what Thomas does. He states his position by the way he votes. Everybody knows it, and most of them respect him for it, and to gang up on him and say, well, we got to get rid of him because he's helping the Democrat. You know, it's preposterous. It's so sad to see that.
There's always a problem whenever the Democrats are kicked out of power, and that problem is the Republicans, because the Republicans are huge spenders, often, very often worse than the Democrats. And there's always an excuse, always. So this time they want to just push it to the end of the year. And, you know, by the time that comes along, all you need is another excuse. So Thomas Massie is standing up. He's not going to go along with it this time. This is supposed to be different. We have Doge. And then last night, President Trump came out with this statement that, I mean, it's just so ridiculous. I'll quote some of it. He said Massie should be primary, and I will lead the charge against him. He's just another grandstander who's too much trouble and not worth the fight. This is where it gets. He reminds me of Liz Cheney before her historic record-breaking fall loss. The people of Kentucky won't stand for it. Just watch. Do I have any takers? End quote. I mean, how outrageous can you get talking about one of the best congressmen in our country? If we only had more of him, we would not be in this mess. And the thing is, we've been down this road before. Anybody who remembers COVID and the trillions of dollars that were printed and the inflation that we suffered because of it, Thomas Massie stood against it. And President Trump lambasted him, called him a third-rate grandstander, had him primaried. Massie was right. Massie won the primary. All that, you know, a ton of that COVID money was fraud. They don't know where it went. He was right. So, I mean, even if it happens that this grand plan that the Republicans have and they end up doing it, okay, you don't attack Congressman Massie like this. It's poor taste and bad judgment by our president.
And as I said during my intro, it is a very simple explanation as to why Trump behaves this way. He is a petty bitch. I'm sorry if you like Trump. Again, there's a lot of things Trump does that I like. Trump has been, in this term specifically, the best president in my lifetime. He's still a petty bitch. He's an absolute petty bitch. Again, his stupid CR, which literally continues all the spending that was allocated under Biden for another 6 months, passed the House anyway because all his other bootlicking bitches went along with one Democrat. So Thomas Massie's had no impact on whether this bill will pass or not. The real problem for Orange Man is there's no Democrats that want to go along with anything Trump's doing, even though in this case they're absolutely being retarded and holding their own breath against their own shit, because the Democrats are literally spouting the same shit Republicans are about this bill. There's too many cuts in it. There's no cuts in it. This actually expands spending, and it allocates money to places like USAID that Trump himself says he's trying to cut. This is the two-faced nature of politics. So the real people that are going to shut this down are the Democrats in the Senate. But watch, and you notice Ron said, well, except for maybe one person in the Senate. And I will forgive Ron for that because Rand Paul is great. He's not qualified, in my opinion, from a consistency level to lace up Thomas Massie's boots, though. Rand Paul's great. Thomas Massie's 100 times more consistent. Rand Paul is absolutely on the hook with AIPAC, like every other member of Congress, except Thomas Massie. Rand Paul is a war hawk in many situations. Thomas Massie is not. But hey, Rand is Ron's son, and Rand is fine. But Rand is going to vote against us, too. Now, Trump will turn around and make Rand the enemy, will be my prediction there. Because Rand's already said, I'm a hard no, and good for him. However, the vote that they're trying to get done in the Senate is not a simple pass-fail vote. It's for something called cloture, and to do that, you need 60 votes. So here's the truth. If you got enough Democrats to vote for it, that it got 59 votes, yeah, you could then say, look, Rand Paul's causing this. But if you are, you know, 6 votes short, and Rand's one of them, Rand's not the cause, is he? Rand has actually nothing to do with whether or not this gets done or not, right? At this point, it's up to the Republicans to go kiss ass and cozy up to enough Democrats to get them to vote yes. Now, again, here's the really interesting thing to me anyway, and just more political bullshit. There's no reason for any Democrat to vote against this bill. This bill literally funds their bullshit for another 6 months. There is not a single cut in the bill, and there's some Congress clown who said, for the first time in my life, I was able to vote for meaningful cuts to government. And I called him a coward and said, come on my show and explain how you did. Because I don't think you did. Let's go through the CR. And of course, no response whatsoever. No. Because he's a fucking coward. Because if it was me and somebody called me a coward and said I was lying, I don't care who that person is. They could be MSNBC, CNN, it could be some small podcaster. If somebody called me out like that, and I could defend my position, I would go wherever necessary to engage with them because my position would be defensible. There is no way to defend this. At the exact same time, Orange Man is putting all this shit in front of you about how the Democrats wasted your money, how they spent it on transgendered operas, how USAID is nothing but a regime change tool and a place for Democrats to launder money. The problem with that explanation is it's not a place for Democrats to launder money. It is a place for politicians and bureaucrats to launder money, and there's probably just as much Republican money laundering in it as there is Democrat money laundering in it. And while he's pointing it out and having Elon do good work and say, look at where your money's going, we need to cut this, he is endorsing and, in fact, attacking someone who won't endorse continuing to do it for at least another 6 months. And then here's the excuse. Here's the excuse. Well, we have to do this now to avoid a government shutdown, which is going to happen because of the Democrats anyway. All right. So what was the point of doing a bill that the Democrats already weren't going to support and were already going to shut down the government with, that gave the Democrats everything that they wanted, except it didn't give them more of what they wanted? In fact, it did give them more of it, because it does increase spending by about another $300 billion, just erasing all the DOGE savings that may not even actually be savings because judges keep saying we have to spend the money anyway. What was the point? Well, the point is we'll be ready to fight in September when you're going to have the same people in the House and the Senate. You're going to fight then. Why not now? You've got the White House, you've got the presidency, right? You got the House, you got the Senate. When will you fight? After the midterms when you lose seats because of this bullshit? You see what I'm saying? This is just, it's so much nonsense. And it has me to the point where, like, I'm starting to understand you guys that are like, I call you special libertarians, you can't take a win. Taking the win actually makes it hurt more because you start to believe that there is any hope for this. There's been some really good things to come out of this, but on the macro, they ain't cutting shit. All they're doing is spending more and enslaving your children, your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren with more debt that they'll never be able to pay. Anyway, moving on, let's hear from Andy McCann about getting some exercise, using standing desks, and things like that.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you here from Woodstock, Georgia and CrossFit Garage, where I am trying to help you be healthy and fit now as well as in the future. So I got a question here forwarded me from Jack from Zeb. Zeb, you got a great question here. Actually, we had our Georgia Tech guys weekend and this came up organically. And I was like, hey, I got this from, the Survival Podcast. Let's talk about this. And so what I'm going to do is build your entire answer into a podcast of mine. So go to Fitness, Food, and Finance, and you can listen to more. But I'm going to give you the summary right here, and I'll try to go quick because we have about 7 minutes. All right, so here we go. Good morning. Can you stand too much utilizing a standing desk while working? So the short answer is yes, but and kind of no. Really, it always comes back to what Jack says. It depends. I work from a desk 8 to 10 hours a day. I have a standing desk and try as much as possible while working to stand up. Is there any point at which you would be advised for me to less or maybe break it up? That's basically the question. And the answer is, Zeb, yeah, that's exactly correct. I would break it up. So I'm going to give you some ideas. And again, I'll flush this fully out over on my side. But here's what you're trying to do. Your body is the ultimate adaptation machine. You can eat vegan and it'll adapt. You can eat carnivore and it'll adapt. Of course, I think carnivore is a better way to go, but you could do ultra running and your body will move to that degree. You could do nothing and your body's tendons will shriek up like, there was a question the other week that, on that, like, hey, I haven't really done much, but I do stuff on my homestead, but I feel like I'm not able to move as well. And that's just, yeah, that's correct. Your body is going to adapt. So I love that you're at a stand-up desk. So you're going to sit down, you're going to stand up. Here's the easy answer. Break it up to where comfortability is sort of being pushed, but you're not really bothering yourself. So you said something about lower back pain. And the answer is yes. You're going to get pain in anything you do when you change up your routine, especially if you're changing it up for that amount of time. So basically a third of your day is now doing whatever it is you weren't doing before. So sitting, you do a lot. Standing, we don't, unless you have that type of job and you build into it. And so there's easy things you can do for that back pain or just to minimize some of that or grow into it. And I think it is awesome to have a stand-up desk. Guys, do this. I actually got a link I'll put in the show notes, or I'll give to Jack and he can put it in the show notes. I got a couple things for you guys on this. So in addition to lower back pain, you may notice your feet swell a bit. Salt may help this, and you may also notice just some other joint pain. It's just lack of use. You're pushing on the edges of comfortability. This is a good thing. What I would do is set a timer, and every 30 minutes or so, stand up to the height, and then lower it to the sitting height. So you're going back and forth. Does it have to be 30 and 30? No. Maybe 45 minutes of standing. It's just giving yourself a break. I'd also do a few other things to help out. The super easy one is while you're standing, shift your weight from side to side. That's kind of like simulating a suitcase carry. This is good for you. It'll help create less imbalance on each side, oddly enough, because it's strengthening the other side as you sway back and forth. The other one is to actually add in some movement. So this is, I'll expand hugely upon it in my side, but this is what my brother said he is doing. And I wrote some of his stuff down. I added a few things on our way home. And so this is what I would do. I would set a timer and do something of this. Not everything, but something. So you can do a door jam squat. You can do a low squat hold. A dumbbell thruster, probably my favorite thing of all time, is grab two dumbbells, drop into a deep squat, and then stand and punch into the air. That's a thruster. You can Google it. I've got a document I'll slide over to Jack as well. And then what I'll do is go back and put some videos to it so you can see what I'm talking about. I would stand up and then go do some burpees. You don't have to do exactly a burpee. Everyone hates those. You can make it an up-down. Calf raises. You can do step-ups. So are you next to a staircase, or can you put a box in there? Do some step-ups. You can do some lunges. You can do some side bends and sit-ups, even if you're trying to lose that butt. Okay, I had to pause there and laugh at myself for the dumb joke. And you can do torso twists as well as arm circles. Another one I like is the Samson stretch. And if you're thinking, I just want to like stretch, yeah, any stretch is good. I would do the sit and reach and just hold. You want to hold for 2 minutes. The other one is foam rolling, and I'm going to include what I do for myself on foam rolling. So I chased a really heavy deadlift. I finally got it and messed my back up. And so now even, I don't know, it's probably been 15 years, I still use this foam roller maintenance routine to keep my back super flexible. So I'll post it there and you can watch it. It's really not that tough. It takes like 5 minutes to do. But yes, the answer to your question is you can do anything too much. And going to a stand-up desk is great, but it creates its own other problems. I would say mixture of sitting and standing is the best way to go. The other thing I would add in there, and my wife has recently done this, is she has got one of these foot pedal machine. So it's basically simulating kind of like a recumbent bike. So you put it under your desk and you can make your feet pedal this device. I'll give Jack a link to that as well. This is the one she uses and it's got thousands of ratings, so it's a pretty good one. Okay, so the two other things that I really like kind of in this area is as you stand more, your plantar fascia tendon will probably shorten up a little bit. So I use these heel seats. I put them in my shoe. Basically, it just goes back in the back. There's this line that goes across just in front of your heels. It's like standing on a roll of dimes. It's actually not a roll of dimes. Maybe like a number two pencil. But anyway, what it's doing is putting pressure on that tendon and helping it lengthen over time. So I had really bad plantar fascia pain for a while, and I put these in, and it went away. So, good stuff. The other thing I really like is these five-fingered type toe socks. Any of them will do. This isn't the one I use, but any of them will do. It's a sock that has individual sleeves for your toes, like it's a glove for your hand. This stuff is good, especially if you're going to be on your feet. You're going to feel pressure in your toes differently. But probably the best thing is movement and maybe the foot pedal, so when you are sitting, at least you're doing something. And I love that this has come up. This was not a thing when I was going through work. Nobody had stand-up desks. This is beautiful. You guys, everyone should be doing this. If you need a stand-up desk, I'll throw a link in there for Jack as well from Amazon. This has got the most reviews and ones that several of my buddies use, and they love it. It's basically, it'll last. It's a desk. It does what it's supposed to do. It holds your stuff, but then it goes up and down, and it never fails. So I like that. I like having a thing that does what it says it does, and you don't have to worry about it. All right, guys. Hey, so my podcast will come out shortly after this, or actually may come out before, depending on when Jack puts out the episodes. And it will be episode number 192 on fitness, food, and finance. As always, you can find me and all the links for you guys at crossfitgarage.com/TSPC.
So I do have all of the products that Andy recommended and his write-up on exercises at your desk in the show notes today. If you just go look up episode 3640 and you scroll down and you see Andy's bullet point, can you really exercise at your desk? You'll see four bullets underneath our sub-bullets that all are hyperlinked out so you can get a look at all that stuff. Next up, let's hear from Joel Riles on moving with your dog with a loose lead and why you might want to.
Hello, TSP crew. This is Joel Riles coming back at you again from Fortress Canine and Canine Academy with another expert counsel question. And we're going through our little mini-series of the biggest mistakes that I see handlers making. And today, we're going to be discussing moving with your dog with a loose lead. And so why is this so important? So we talked about not getting frustrated. We talked about having clear communication with your dog. And what happens a lot of times with our handlers is they feel like in order to control their dog's movements, this is especially true when their dog's walking at their side. We call that foos. Some people call it heel. So they'll be walking with their dog, and let's say they're going to make a turn toward their dog. All of a sudden, they feel like they have to use the lead to force the dog's direction in the direction they're going to turn. Either they're turning away from the dog or they're turning toward the dog. And all of a sudden, they start relying on their lead. And then oftentimes what happens is this creates a confusing situation for the dog. The dog gets completely out of position, or the person ends up relying completely on the lead in order to be able to walk alongside their dogs. Their dogs start pulling on the lead, and it just kind of escalates into an issue. And so, of course, if that starts escalating, what happens? You get frustrating. If that starts escalating, what happens? The dog gets confused in your communication, and it's not clear. So one of the ways that we can both avoid being overly frustrated and have clear and concise communication with the dog is we deliberately maintain a loose lead with the dog at all times. So if I'm walking with my dog, what I generally do is I'll start by putting my dog at my side in a foos. So foos just means to be at my side, right? I might be walking or I might be standing still. You're still in a foos if you're by my side. And then the dog is either sitting or standing. I don't want them laying down for this. And then I'm going to adjust the length of lead that I have in my hand, and I'm going to exercise a natural arm swing, right? A little bit back, a little bit forward. Like if I was walking naturally and my arm was swinging back and forth as I'm walking, and I want to make sure that within that motion of my arm swinging back and forth, the lead is not going tight. On the back side, I only want there to be about an inch, maybe 2 inches of slack though, in that lead, so that if the dog gets a little bit ahead of me, that lead's going to bump them on my backswing, right? And I'm going to be walking with the dog with a loose lead. Now, if the dog starts to get ahead of me, I'm going to do a deliberate backswing, but I'm only going to stop at the spot where my hand naturally goes back to. I'm not going to go farther than that, because if there's a bump the first time and then my arm swings forward, as I come back on that second arm swing, I'm just going to have a firm boom right to that stopping spot. Now, the dog could feel that bump on the first rotation and back up a little bit. And then I can do that motion, boom, with my hand. There's not going to be any correction for the dog because they're back where they're supposed to be. And I have slack. I have a loose lead. So that dog is not going to feel any correction from that motion. But if they're still out ahead of me, then as I come back and go, boom, they're going to feel a correction. But as soon as that lead goes tight for that correction, pop, my arm moves forward again. The lead goes loose again. If I'm trying to direct the dog to do things and they don't do it and they need a correction, I go pop, and then the lead is loose again. I want to maintain a loose lead with my dog. Now, why is this important? It's important for several reasons. The first and most important reason in my mind is that we often give very confusing direction to our dogs when our leads are tight, and we don't even realize it. We're moving our arms in various different ways. We're moving our body in various different ways, and all of those things are creating tension on that lead in various different directions when our lead is tight on the dog, and the dog's wondering, what the heck is it you want me to do? I'm getting tugged this way and that way and all sorts of things. Sometimes our dog will sit, because if we lift up on our lead, that's a lead direction for the dog to sit. So I may not even give a command. I just lift straight up on the lead. As the dog starts to sit, I relax the lead. But if my lead is tight all the time and my dog starts to sit, but the lead doesn't get loose, then all of a sudden they start moving around. They might start jumping up and putting their paws on us. We get mad, frustrated, like we talked about the last two segments ago, right? Because our dog's jumping on us. But why are they jumping on us? Because they're trying to figure out what the hell it is we want to make that lead go loose. And so by maintaining a loose lead constantly, then I'm only giving the lead direction to the dog when I'm doing it deliberately. I might lift up on the lead and create tension for a second to communicate sit, but then as soon as they sit, I relax that lead. I might pop the dog to give them a correction, but as soon as that correction is over with, the lead goes loose again. I want to learn to move alongside my dog and to communicate to them and get them to do the things that I want them to do without having to tug and pull and always be relying on my lead. The other reason that that's really important is that most people at some point want the ability to have at least some level of off-lead control with their dogs. Well, how do you get off-lead control with your dog? You get your dog to the point where at your side with a loose lead, they will do all of the commands. They will walk beside you. They'll hup when you tell them to hup. They'll wait when you tell them to wait. They'll sit when you tell them to sit. And I don't need to use that lead. Now, I might give them corrections, but if I'm having to constantly correct a dog to sit every time I tell them seats, then I'm not correcting hard enough. And if I increase the level of my correction without getting frustrated again, then the dog goes, oh, okay, when you say sit, I'm just going to sit. I'm not going to wait for you to pop me with the lead. I'm just going to do it. And after a while, I'm moving with my dog, and every command I give them, they follow the command without me having to use the lead. Pretty soon, I can start dropping that lead. I'm going to leave it attached to the dog, and I'm going to let them drag it behind them just in case they start to get sloppy and I need to pick it back up again. But this is our progression toward getting that off-lead obedience. So I start by managing my dog with a loose lead until I notice, okay, I can pretty much give my dog any of the commands that I'm giving them, and I don't have to use the lead. Now I can start dropping the lead, letting them drag it behind them. I might have to stop and pick it up every once in a while. Hey, pay attention. I can still grab this thing if I need to. And they're like, oh, okay, I'll follow your commands even though the lead's just dragging behind me. And then after, say, 3, 4, 5, 6 months of that, I can start taking that lead off and just going, let's go, hup. Good hup, attaboy, good go. And they'll start listening and obeying even when there's no lead at all. So it clarifies our communication to the dog. It makes sure that we're not giving confusing clarification to the dog. And it's our step in the direction of getting that off-lead obedience that so many people want. Now, if you want a lot more details and specifics on exactly how we go through this process, you can go check out Canine Academy by visiting thesurvivalpodcast.com. On the right-hand side, scroll down until you see the Canine Academy banner and click on that so that Jack gets credit for the sale. And then we would be happy to help you out. If you're struggling, once you're signed up for that, you can email or text me directly, and I will help you out, and we'll make sure we work through any problems that you have. If you're looking for a fully obedience-trained dog or a fully trained protection dog, check out FortressK9.com and click on the consult button. We'll reach out and make communication with you, and we'll get you taken care of. Always remember, follow your ABTs, always be training. Everything you do with your dog is training your dog to either do what you want or allowing them to do something that you don't want if you're not correcting them when they have bad behaviors. So remember your ABCs, always be following that. And until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
So, of course, he's absolutely right. This is his life. And I'll just put a little bit of a different angle on it so you can reinforce it for yourself. So, When you're out with your dog, okay, one thing you have to understand is you're training your dog even if you don't know you are. And so as much as this will apply to people that are heavily working with their dog all the time, that are training their dog as a protection dog or a service dog or something, they're going to have less problems with what he's talking about than the average person, and this is why. You're probably training your dog that there's danger when the leash goes tight, whether you know it or not, and here's why. You're walking through a park. Here comes somebody with another dog, right? What is the first thing that you do? You tighten up and you shorten the lead and you push the dog off to the other side and you become tense. And the dog reads this as there is something dangerous, and then he sees the other dog and he says, aha, it must be him, and then they want to fight. Because the other guy probably did the exact same thing. Think about it this way. Dogs interpret your body language and your energy better than you can do it with another person. Dogs are way better at it than we are, okay? Now, I want you to think about this. You and a friend are walking together, let's say in a park. Along comes a person walking the other direction. That person happens to be a person that your friend has had problems with in the past, some kind of a bully or something like that. And you notice your friend, he doesn't say anything, but his hand clenches into a fist. His demeanor changes, his shoulders square, and he locks onto that person like he hates them. Do you not notice? Are you not like, hey, what's going on? Okay, now, at least you can ask, and your friend can tell you. Now, the dog is way more alert to this going on than you will ever be, but the dog can't ask the question. So whenever a dog feels a lead tight, and especially a dog that's been well-trained and knows what a correction from the leash is, it thinks either I'm doing something wrong or something bad is happening and I need to be ready. Neither of these are the energy states you want your dog in, unless it literally is a dangerous situation where you want the dog up and you want the dog ready to defend you. So just kind of take that as a reinforcement that whenever that dog feels tension in that leash, it's either something bad's about to happen or I've done something wrong. And you just as you don't want to scold a child who's doing what you ask them to do. If you tell your kid to pick up his toys and he's actually picking up his toys, you shouldn't be raising your voice and telling him to pick his toys up. He's already doing it. He's already doing what you asked. And so then you create confusion, and the canine brain is more easy to confuse like this than the human brain. The human brain can rationalize that's having a bad day. The dog expects you to behave like a great big super smart dog, and you only project what you really mean. That's how dogs are. Anyway, good stuff from Joel. Let's move on and talk about guns with Mike Melito.
What is going on, TSP? Mike Melito here from Gunfighter Life Podcast. Happy to answer your gun questions. This one comes from Brock from up in Canada. How do I go about replacing a stock? Details. Last fall, I purchased a 357 Chiapa Mayor's leg. It took a fall out of my tree stand, and the stock broke. He goes on to say that he did try and contact the manufacturer, but that was not a help. Now, here's where this gets tricky. I know more people are going to listen to this than just Brock, so I'm going to give a broad range of advice. Many of these copy lever guns, whether they're made in Italy or Turkey or whatever, are copies of older designs. This one is a copy of a Winchester Model 1892. I don't know if all the small parts will interchange, but likely many of them will, and likely the stocks will interchange. I went on eBay before I recorded this, and there was an entire list to the point where I got tired of scrolling where they had Winchester Model 1892 stocks. Now, this is not legal advice. I know here in America, you could not, for example, take a mayor's leg, which if you don't know is like a shortened... It's like if you took a regular lever action pistol caliber carbine and you chop the stock off and you chop the barrel off in a chop saw. If you took that in America and put a proper stock on it, that would be an SBR. If you wanted to go that route, since you already have a broken gun, you could just pay the $200 tax stamp and put a full-size stock on it. But if you do that without putting the tax stamp on it, then it would be felonious. So don't do that. Now, if you get a replacement stock and cut it to exactly the same length before you ever installed it on your gun, I don't know if there is any ATF issue with that at all. If you were going to do that, you need to check with the ATF or with there in Canada. The other thing is, this is not safety advice. I'm not telling you you should do this. I'm telling you one could do this. And if this were mine, I might do this. You could not just regular wood glue, but get some really strong kind of epoxy, because I assume it broke at the wrist of the stock, because that's the most fragile part. You could put some really strong epoxy in there, clamp it down. You could get some really stout loads, like a buffalo bore load, put it in a lead sled or some kind of rest like that, backed up against a cinder block or something that has little to no give, much less than you're going to have when you shoot it. Tie a string around it. Be safe and test fire it a couple of times. I'm not telling you that's safe. I'm telling you, if it were me, that's what I might do. If it's a polymer stock, put some super glue on it, not for structural integrity, just to hold it in place, and then go inside some high-strength resin fiberglass on the inside of those stocks, because they're almost always hollow, and patch it up internally that way and test it the same way. Or you could do like a lot of poor rednecks do in the South. You could keep that like an old broken-down car as a donor if you really like the gun. Get that one or like a normal-sized rifle version of it, and keep that one for spare parts. Those are some solutions that I have for you. I hope one of those helps, Brock. I got another quick question here. It's from JQ in the UK. He's looking for a semi-automatic 22 for rabbit shooting and occasional target shooting. Now, a lot of times I throw out a bunch of options and give you the pros and cons. JQ, here's the deal. This one's easy. Get a Ruger 10/22. If you want blued steel and wood, they got that. If you want stainless steel and synthetic, they got that. If you want a more tactical model, they make it. And because they're so prolific, they're so modular, you can, I believe, make one with no parts that are actual original Ruger factory parts. So I don't know a lot about UK laws, but I imagine they're more restrictive than here. So get one with the action that you like and the barrel that you like, because I think a barrel in some of those European countries is a restrictive part. But then aftermarket stocks, you mentioned you want to shoot subsonics in it. They even make kits and springs, I would recommend, because changing the recoil spring is kind of a pain in the butt. Just get an entire spring operating rod, spring guide, and handle. They're cheap. You can swap out, if it doesn't reliably cycle, some of the subsonic ammo if you're running it suppressed over there in the UK. You mentioned you don't mind spending money. If you want the creme de la creme, there are a lot of really high-end aftermarket 10/22, Frankenstein 10/22s. One of the best ones, in my opinion, is the Tactical Solutions. Look up Taxol 10/22, you'll see it. They also make a bunch of different variants. If you just want to go premium right off the bat, then you might look at that one. But a lot of times we're like, well, this gun, this model is this way, and this one is that, and the Glock is super dependable, but it's got horrible ergonomics. And like for this, if you're asking for a semi-automatic 22, unless you just want something different, I'm going to tell you, get a Ruger 10/22. At some point, I just opened a box last night with a new stock from Magpul for my old Ruger 10/22 that I bought when I was 16. I actually had my mom go to Walmart and buy me because I was too young. Still have it. Hopefully, I'll get to shoot it today. It's a fantastic gun. So Ruger 10/22, whatever flavor you like. 1022 is probably coming more flavors than Baskin Robbins. So there you go. Hope that helps. Thanks, TSP. Thanks, Jack. Have a blessed day.
I completely agree on the 1022. I mean, I completely agree that if you want a semi-auto 22, your best choice is a Ruger 1022, which is the number one best-selling 22 rifle in history, and I believe the best-selling rifle in all history, like of all rifles ever. The second best, and you know, Michael Saylor says with Bitcoin there is no second best. With semi-auto 22s, there is a second best. I don't know if it's even still made, if they call it something else now, but the Marlin Model 60, which is a tubular magazine, semi-auto 22, the one thing I will say about it from a standpoint of being number two to Ruger's number one, Ruger's number one because of all the things Mike said here, but the reality is the Model 60 has some things about it that I actually prefer. And again, I haven't looked at these forever, so I don't even know if what I'm about to say applies to one made yesterday, if they still make it. But old school Model 60 Marlin, the thing about that gun, it actually points a lot nicer than a 1022. It's lighter than a 1022. It is not magazine fed, but it's also more inherently accurate. And when I say accurate, like people like, you know, can you shoot better? You know, most of the shooting we do with 22s is like 25 to 50 yards. And I don't know about you. I can't speak for anybody else. But for me, yes, I can shoot at a level where that accuracy difference does matter. I can drill dimes at 50 yards. And the micro groove barrel of the Marlin is just one of the most inherently accurate things ever done with rimfire, period. My favorite gun that I own to this day, and I'm sitting here looking at two semi-auto 22s as I say this, okay, that are leaning up against my wall, and neither of them is the one I'm about to say, is a 1980s generation Model 25 Marlin bolt action. So that doesn't answer the listener's question because they didn't ask about that. But I've been asked a lot, like, when I move my kid, my son, my daughter, from air guns to firearms, where should I start? High quality, bolt action, 22 is always the answer that I give to that question. Next up, let's talk to Ryan Steve of the Homestead Consultant about whole house water filtration systems.
Hey, Jack and TSP community. This is Ryan Siva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today, I've got a question from Chris, and Chris asks, what is the best whole home water filtration system? And some of his details are that he is on municipal water. He's wanting to remove fluoride and chlorine or chloramine. So there are five broad categories of chemicals that get injected into municipal water supplies. The first is disinfectants. Typically, that's going to be chlorine or chloramine. Chlorine is very common, probably the most common, but chloramine is becoming more and more common. It's being used instead of chlorine because it lasts longer in the system, because it's less volatile and it evaporates. It does not evaporate well, and that is a bit of an issue because that also means that you can't smell it. So with chlorine, if you put it into a sink and it starts to evaporate, you'll smell that. And with chloramine, you don't smell it, so you're kind of tricked into thinking that it's okay to drink because you don't have that off smell. And the way that they make chloramine is they take chlorine and they mix it with ammonia. The next broad category is corrosion inhibitors, which includes phosphates and silicates. The third broad category is pH adjusters, so sodium hydroxide, lime calcium hydroxide, and carbon dioxide. The fourth major common chemical agents that are injected is coagulants and flocculants. Those are used to basically take dissolved solids and in the water, it will pull those out and drop them to the bottom so that they can be easily removed, which in and of itself isn't a bad thing because a lot of those solids are going to be things like heavy metals, organic materials. The chemicals that are used to do that are ammonium sulfate and ferric chloride or ferric sulfate, both not particularly great chemicals for you to be ingesting. And then the fifth and final common elements to be added are fluoridation agents. Now, there's three general fluoridation agents, and we could have a very long and interesting discussion on the use of fluoridation in water, municipal water systems. But to keep it short here, I would just say do your research if you haven't already dug into it. It's a really interesting rabbit hole as to why we started using fluoridation and where that all came from. However, the gist of it is you don't want fluoride in your gut, and because it's a contact agent, and if it does anything for your teeth, it's in contacting them, not in ingesting it. So I'm going to recommend a three-level system, the first being a whole home water filtration system. It's a traditional mechanical water filtration system. If needed, a descaler system after that general home water filter system, and a point-of-use water filter system for drinking water. So let's start with the general whole home water filter. I'm recommending the iSpring family of products because that's what I personally use. I've been really happy with them as far as a value brand or price-to-value comparison. The filter that I would start with in line would be the iSpring WGB32BM. It's a three-stage whole home filtration system. The first stage is the general sediment filter at 5 microns. The second stage is the carbon block filter. That's going to remove your chlorine pretty much entirely, VOCs or volatile organic compounds, most pesticides, and general bad tastes and odors in the water. And then the third stage in the system is going to remove iron, manganese, and lead. It will also reduce heavy metals like aluminum, ferric chloride, and ferric sulfide, as well as mercury. So it will reduce those, not fully eliminate them. This filter is great in that if you're using the water after it's filtered through it, you are greatly reducing the chloramine, basically entirely removing the chlorine and many of the other things that your body would actually absorb through the skin or through the dermis. So it's I'm very comfortable in basically using the water from this system for showering in, and I've really noticed a difference in frizziness of hair and flakiness of or harshness of skin after installing this filter for my entire family. So I really recommend it for general filtration. Now, the next thing that I would put in line from the system, if you need it, is a descaling system. Traditionally, this would be a water softener, and if you really want that soft water feel, I'd still go with a water softener. However, if you're just looking to make the water a little bit less hard and not damage your plumbing system, there are a couple of new options out. One is the electrolytic descaler. The way that it works basically is it changes the electrical charge on the particles so that they don't stick to the pipes. So the electrolytic descaler can do a lot for you, but it is limited in how hard of water it can handle. So keep that in mind. The one that I recommend is the iSpring. It's the ED2000. And I'll have links in the show notes that I'll give Jack for a whole write-up that I've done on this if you want to dive a bit deeper. There's also a filter descaler that iSpring makes. It is the iSpring WDS80K. This one will soften more water or keep it from scaling your system at a higher level than the electrolysis descaler. However, you do have to replace the filter every 6 to 12 months, depending on use. And then finally, my last recommendation in line is the point-of-use RO system, or reverse osmosis. And these systems, reverse osmosis basically removes 99 to 99.9% of contaminants within water. So you basically get extremely pure water coming out of this system. Now, these point-of-use systems are really just for drinking water, but we've removed most of the chemicals that cause issues with the skin or can be absorbed through the dermis. Now we're dealing with the remaining chemicals like fluoride that isn't readily absorbed through the skin, but is detrimental to health. So I would recommend putting a point of use reverse osmosis system in, and these can filter either to just a little spigot on the side of your sink, or you can also connect them to your refrigerator. I hope that helps, Chris, as far as getting you on the right track. There's a lot to think about and sort through as far as water filter systems, but that is my general recommendation for a whole home system. If anybody else wants information about what I do and how I help homesteaders, just go to thehomesteadconsultant.com. I've got lots of free resources there for you if you want to dig into that as well.
And he did mention a write-up in there on the chemicals used in municipal water systems. It's a Google Drive shareable doc, and I do have a link right under Ryan's bullet point to that if you would like to get your hands on that document. All right, moving on, let's talk about milk kefir for health and how it came into Nicole Sauce's life through Health for Dogs, and yet now she's applying it to herself as well.
Hey, TSP, Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Holler Roast Coffee with a segment about kefir. A while back, Joel Riles mentioned that feeding your dogs a quarter cup to a half cup of kefir every day really helps them reduce joint inflammation and pain, and we started doing that here, and it's been amazing. And then I thought, well, if it helps with doggy joint inflammation, maybe it helps with human joint inflammation. So I started giving them a half a cup, drinking half a cup, and going on with my life. But here's the thing. Kefir is an amazing addition to your world. It's very, very easy to maintain from a from-scratch living standpoint. So I wanted to share with you a little bit about how to make kefir, what it is, and how to build it into your life, some ways you can use it. First of all, I would say, why build kefir into your life? We do live in a world where the standard American diet that we have adopted, not only in the U.S., but globally, has really taken an assault on our intestinal gut health. And rebuilding that can take many years. Kefir is one key to helping to rebuild that. And when your gut microbiology is in balance, then it's better for your immune system, makes you stronger as a person, and frankly, you just feel better. But it's also a way to address something about milk that may not fit great in a ketogenic lifestyle or carnivore lifestyle, and that is there's a lot of carbs in milk. What happens when the bacteria get active in it and start turning milk into kefir is they eat a lot of those carbs and turn them into something beneficial for the body. So the third reason to do it is it's just delicious and a great way to augment some of the dishes that you may already be making. Microbiologically speaking, kefir is a very unique thing. And I'm talking about milk kefir here, or dairy kefir, and not water kefir. Totally different segment for water kefir. It's made from kefir grain. And I used to think kefir grain was somehow magically derived from the wheat in the field. This is before I knew anything about it. It has nothing to do with that. And the cool thing about it is nobody can really track historically how kefir grains came to be. They just know that they did. And they have nothing to do with wheat or other grains. It's also fun that the scientists have not been able to create kefir grains. So all the kefir that we drink today are based on an accidental thing that happened when other cultures in the Caucasus Mountain ranges, we think, came up with a SCOBY that works in dairy. So just like the SCOBY that works in kombucha, this is like a dairy SCOBY, except for they're little grain-shaped things. And if you want to get your hands on it, well, we'll talk about that a little bit later. What's different about kefir versus yogurt, because they do taste very similar, is that kefir has three primary sets of bacteria, where yogurt will have like a mesophilic culture, a single kind. So it's got lactobacillus family of bacteria. It has yeast. And it has acetobacter, all three of these working in balance. The really cool thing is that yeast, right, it creates CO2 and alcohol when it eats sugar, which can be super fun. Well, the acetobacter eats the ethanol and turns that into acid. So you're actually reducing the chance of having alcohol in your kefir by having this balance. And what that yields is a very delicious, tart, creamy, sort of yogurty, light yogurty consistency drink. One thing to note about this is the combination of these three bacteria families in the process of fermenting milk into kefir. A lot of people who have dairy allergies or lactose allergies are able to tolerate milk kefir. So if you're one of those people, I mean, and you want to try it, like try a little bit and see if you have symptoms, but it can be a way to access some of the benefits of dairy that you wouldn't necessarily get because you're allergic to it. In fact, my neighbor, he's totally going to try this to see if it's something he can digest. He's tried goat's milk too, and that doesn't work. So we'll see. We'll see. But because this family of three bacteria are eating all of the things that they can possibly eat to turn this into kefir, it tends to be less harmful to people with the dairy allergies. So the big question comes, how do you make it? This is the easiest ferment you will ever do in your entire life. And I consider sauerkraut to be a very easy ferment. This one's even easier than that. What you need to do is get your hands on some kefir grain. Now, you can get dried kefir grain, reconstitute them, and bring them back to life. And when you're doing this, be sure that you are getting the milk kefir grain and not the water kefir grain. So bring them back to life and then just start making it. Or better is to source already living, active kefir grain, which if you know how kombucha works, you know that there's probably somebody in your community that has way more than they need and they're throwing them in their compost pile. Or you can buy them on Amazon and other places. But you get yourself some active kefir grain. My first batch started with a quarter cup and I put it in the bottom of a pint mason jar and then I took whole milk and I topped it up and I put a fermentation lid on that. You can just put a coffee filter in a lid. What you're trying to do is keep any nasty flies from getting in there or whatnot. And then you put it on your counter, unless your counter is 9,000 degrees. But, you know, if you are in the 65 to 75 degree range, which most kitchen counters are, you just put it out until it's done. And this is the only tricky part of kefir. It's going to go at the speed it goes on. It's a combination of how active the bacteria are. It's a combination and your temperatures, and as they get more alive and you use them more and more, it happens faster and faster and faster, and you can do higher volumes. So you leave it on the counter until it's done. The way you know it's done, you don't stir it or shake it or anything. The way you know it's done is if you like gently rock the jar from side to side, you'll see that it has changed consistency to more yogurt-like. Like consistency, when that's done, then you pour that through a mesh sieve or colander. I use a bigger colander, and I hold it over a wide mouth pot, so because mine's kind of big and wide, so that the grains stay in the sieve and the milk kefir filters through. However, it doesn't just filter through. So I take a spatula and scrape it sort of down along the side of the colander to keep the grains on top, because if you like force it down from the top, you might actually push them through. You don't want to lose your grains. And once all of the milk kefir is in the pot and the grains are in the colander, I flop those into my next mason jar, put milk in it, put it on the counter, pour what's in the pot into a mason jar to store in the fridge, and then I use it. So then the next question comes up, how do I use it? Well, there's lots of ways you can use it. I just take a gulp of it when I give it to my dogs every morning, but I've also used it in place of yogurt or sour cream in salad dressing recipes. I added it to a stroganoff that I was making here, and that was super delicious. You can use it like sour cream. You can use it like yogurt. You can strain it through a cheesecloth and make a farmer's cheese by adding like salt and garlic and spreading that on whatever you spread farmer's cheese on. There's any way that you can use sour cream or yogurt in cooking, you can use kefir as well. Of course, if you heat it up very much, you will deactivate the bacteria. You'll kill them by boiling them. But that's, you know, if you just want the flavor, that works as well. I've even thought about using them instead of mayonnaise in deviled eggs. I think that would be delicious. Anyway, I hope this gets you really interested into the whole world of kefir and how easy it is to build into your life. It takes me about 2 minutes every 2 to 3 days to make kefir. And when I want to slow a batch down, I throw it in the fridge and wait till I'm ready to deal with it. And With those characteristics, that means somebody who's fairly busy on the homestead, but also traveling to give presentations and such. I can keep up with it without ending up with a huge crash. And that's imperative in my life here on the homestead that work well. And I get all the health benefits of something that's home fermented, because the store fermented stuff, they usually don't use kefir grain. So you're not getting that trio of bacteria families. If you want to know more about kefir, you can check out a podcast episode I did on it earlier this week, episode 1012 at livingfreeintennessee.com. Make it a great week.
So one thing I want to point out is there's, because we're about to have a segment here from Ken Daniels on inflammation, there are a lot of people that have very inflammatory responses to dairy. Typically, fermented dairy products don't have as much of an inflammatory response for people. Additionally, raw milk products tend to have less of a problem for many people because there's enzymes that are in raw milk that are not destroyed by the pasteurization process of pasteurized milk that aid in the digestion of the milk, and that actually happens to be why they're in the milk in the first place, not for you, but for the animal's baby, right? Whether it's a cow or some other, like, you know, sheep's milk or goat's milk or whatever. That's why those enzymes are there. They are a digestion aid for the consumption of the milk, and specifically breaking down and not causing problems from the lactose in the milk. So that's just, when you ferment, you tend to mitigate inflammatory and other issues that can come from dairy, which just reminded me that I forgot to tell you something in the beginning that I really want to make sure that you guys know about. It's my last chance to tell you about it. Today at 3 p.m. my time, that's Central Time, so like 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, I am doing a webinar with the Price Pottinger Foundation, and that's going to be on biochar. However, the reason I bring them up here is because the Price Pottinger Association is basically a conservatory of all the knowledge of Dr. Weston A. Price, who was a dentist who traveled around the world to examine indigenous societies and say, do they get sick? Do they get modern diseases? What are their teeth? As a dentist, you know, what are their teeth like? Teeth health, bone health are very linked. And he found that all of these societies in all these places all over the world, separated by thousands of miles, who ate drastically different things, had certain things in common in what they ate. And all of them were dramatically and very, very healthy and didn't even have issues that we have in modern society, like most of these people had never seen a dentist in their life, yet they had a full mouth full of teeth, including their wisdom teeth, which came in straight somehow. And so his book is an amazing book that you should totally read. But Price Pottinger is that conservatory and continues to do Dr. Price's work going forward. And they are, you know, I don't want to say anything completely horrible, but I am not a fan of the Weston A. Price Foundation and Sally Fallon. I'm just not. The two organizations get along at this point. There's some history behind it. I'll leave it there. But the people that are actually doing the work that is sanctioned by the family conservatory of Dr. Price is Price Pottinger. And they're definitely worth considering becoming a member of their society for things like this, or that you wouldn't know unless I was involved in this was happening today. And they do a lot of really great work. And I think I'm going to be digging more into nutrition in the future that's more based on less keto carnivore and more based on like what food people should actually be eating in the first place. And I think that's naturally going to push you toward the kind of a ketone style diet, but not necessarily everybody's going to live that way. And certainly not all these people live that way. And there's indigenous societies, as long as we're not helping them with sacks of flour and shit all over the world, eating all these varied diets, and they're all remarkably healthy and none of them are obese and they don't have any type 2 diabetes, very low cancer incidences, etc. Well, maybe this traditional ancestral eating is the way to go. And just maybe, you know, highly carnivorous just is one version of that. And that'll fit in well with our next segment from Chef Ken Daniels on developing recipes that are disinflammatory.
Hello all, Ken with BloodSugarChef.com. This week's question comes from Rich What are some different flavor profiles or cooking techniques that would help incorporate a more anti-inflammatory vegetables and spices? Rich later goes on to say he and his wife are looking to start a more diabetic-friendly lifestyle. Yeah, this question resonates deeply with me at my personal experience right now. As many of you know, I've been navigating the challenges of diabetes, striving to eat healthier, and discovering what truly works for my body. Every day I look at my damaged eye and I'm reminded of the consequences of a bad lifestyle choice. If I can break the addiction to carbs, which I still crave, by the way, but it's getting much, much better, so can you. And weirdly, I'm starting to crave red meat and fat much more than sugar now. It's been a weird change. Okay, so through my recent experiences, I found that consuming red meat like beef, lamb, deer, bison has been the most anti-inflammatory thing for me. I actually feel it. I feel it in my vitality. Sure, there's days where I'm not feeling 100%, but the good days vastly outweigh the bad now, and I'm not 100% carnivore yet. I am very much into the keto lifestyle, consuming about 25 to 50 carbs per day. 100% of those carbs are coming from veggies. I have proudly stopped consuming sugar, sweeteners, grains, and all processed foods. If you want to talk about anti-inflammatory, I feel this is the biggest change. But yes, I still eat veggies. It's important to note that while this approach has benefited me, individual responses can vary. Some vegetables, for instance, have caused me discomfort and increased inflammation. Nightshade vegetables like tomatoes, peppers, or eggplants, they tend to trigger inflammation in my body, so I tend to cut back on them, if not cut them out entirely. So this highlights the importance of personal experimentation with diet. I cannot stress this enough, though. One of the best ways to track how food affects you is through food journaling. Writing down what you eat and noting how you feel afterwards can reveal patterns over time. I know it's tedious, but it really does help. On the flip side, tracking which foods make you feel great also can help fine-tune your diet for optimal energy and reduced inflammation. One last side note before we get to the answer. Lately, I've noticed if I don't get quality sleep and hydrate efficiently throughout my day, forget it. I'll get big cortisol dumps because my body feels stressed and there's almost no amount of anti-inflammatory advice that helps me. I need sleep, I need plenty of water, and I need moderate electrolytes. Now let's get to the question. This is solely based on what I've eaten and some basic research and nutrients. First off, leafy greens. Dark leafy greens like spinach, kale, and Swiss chard are rich in vitamin A, C, and K, as well as antioxidants that combat inflammation. Their slight bitter flavor can be balanced by sauteing them with a little garlic and olive oil, a combination that only enhances the taste but adds some anti-inflammatory benefits. Usually toss them in my morning egg scramble. Number two, cruciferous vegetables. This is where I get most of my carbs from. Vegetables such as broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts contain a compound that reduces inflammation. Roasting these veggies caramelizes their natural sugars, giving them delightful sweetness, a little bit of crispy texture. For me, the air fry is my best friend with these veggies. I toss them with some butter, turmeric, and black pepper before roasting to amplify some of their anti-inflammatory effects. Ginger. As we all know, ginger has been used for centuries for medicinal purposes, including its ability to reduce inflammation. Its spicy, aromatic flavor was really versatile in both sweet and savory dishes. I try adding it to like stir fries, broths. I even just brew it as a tea. This is not only enhances the flavor, but it provides some really good digestive benefits. Let's talk about garlic now. Garlic is not only a flavor powerhouse, but also boasts anti-inflammatory properties. It's delicious, and if you don't like garlic, I question if we can actually be friends. But here's a tip. You cut or crush your garlic and let it sit for about 10 minutes. It actually helps activate its beneficial compounds. I use it in base sauces, marinades, and I simply saute it with vegetables. Lastly, avoiding omega-6. Another huge change for me is the removal of all nut oils in my diet. This one can be tricky, even for an old chef like me. So even if you're eating quality veggies that you may like, if you're still sauteing them in canola oil or you're adding in a dressing that's emulsified with soybean or corn oil, you're certainly getting the negative effects of inflammation. I've got an article I wrote to help explain what nut oils are on bloodsugarchef.com. You can be absolutely certain that anything in a box that's processed is loaded with omega-6. It's a new discovery for me, and I've been realizing how much we unknowingly consume omega-6. Before I end, the response to my personal battle with diabetes and the eagerness to participate in bloodsugarchef.com has been humbling. The wife and I are currently moving, so there's a bit of a delay in getting back to some of you. I've been really diving into the American Diabetes Society website. They have some great meal plans for a better way to eat. However, there are no recipes, so I am starting to develop recipes based on their meal plans. I am in no way associated with the American Diabetes Society, but I am trying out their info, and the recipes are needed, so I am creating them on my website, bloodsugarchef.com. Please note, the recipes are not finished. I am currently in the process of moving. I do think it will help anyone interested in eating better, and actually, this includes you, Rich. As soon as we unpack the house, I'll be reaching out to Dr. Ken Berry in hopes that he can be a part of what we're starting. starting, then I've got some big things coming. So stay tuned. So please go over to my website, bloodsugarchef.com, join the Blood Pact email list, and leave a comment or email. Hearing your personal struggles and strengths helps me get through the rough days and the shitty glucose numbers. Until next time, this is Chef Ken. Cheers.
I will say, as you're figuring this out, one of the best things you can do is to keep a health journal that includes everything that you eat. It is important to figure out what triggers things in you. And I'll bring up an instance that Ken mentioned. And if it works for him, he should keep doing it. So I'm not pushing back on it. I'm just saying, I find there are a lot of people that say that they get inflammatory responses when they consume nightshades like peppers, tomatoes, and eggplants. I eat a lot of peppers and tomatoes and eggplants, not year-round. I eat lots of peppers, tomatoes, and eggplants when they're in season. So that maybe gives my body a break from it. But I've also found that a lot of times people would say, like, this particular food causes this particular negative reaction in me. And at the time they're saying it, it is the truth. But it is because it is being combined with other things. And even when you stop all the things that cause the problem, it takes your body time to adapt and detoxify and go through things like autophagy and replace and rebuild so that it gets back to processing foods in a way that don't cause you problems. And I've talked to several people who said, man, I figured out when I started cleaning up my diet, I had to stay away from nightshades. And then they're like, and a year and a half later, I was somewhere and somebody had something with some peppers in it. And I'm like, I'll risk it. And then another thing happened. And then I started trying to eat peppers again, and nothing happened. And when I ate tomatoes again, nothing happened. And it was all like it just never happened, but I know that it happened. And I think it's more about interactions. And there are things that have very strong interactions that by themselves don't really do anything. One of them would be, ayahuasca, right? The drug, the super hallucinogenic drug where you trip balls for like 2 to 3 days. It is made from two different plants that grow in kind of South American Amazonia region that the shamans figured out. Now, how the hell they ever to put these two things that neither of them really do anything by themselves, neither one of them is really good for food, neither one of them really tastes good, neither one of them really does anything, but when you put them together, you get this response. That's pretty interesting into itself. There's the belief that it was given to them by the gods or something, and who knows? Maybe it was just peanut butter and chocolate, even though neither one tasted good. I don't know. But my point is that that's a perfect example of something that you could eat a handful of either of these things, and you might maybe have a little stomach ache or something because it's not really great food, but nothing really would happen. But when you put the two together, it opens up this hallucinogenic response. So if you don't think that regular foods can then stack and then either aggravate or even create responses that you wouldn't normally have. You know, is your metabolism right? Is your digestive system right? So many people, the answer to that question is an affirmative no. And so that's why diets like paleo, primal, keto, carnivore are so successful for so many people. It isn't necessarily that maybe that's where they need to be forever, and some people are going to be great staying on one of those forever, right? What I'm saying, though, is they're elimination diets. And when we eliminate as much as possible that can cause us problems, then the body has time to heal. So there's just take a different analogy, and we'll move on to my segment. Can you run? Most of you would say, yeah, I can run. Maybe I'm not very fast, but I can run. Is it healthy for you to run? If I don't overdo it, sure. You know, okay, but if you sprained your left ankle really bad, then nobody except an idiot would tell you, hey, to make your ankle better, run. They would say, rest the ankle, elevate the ankle, use compression on the ankle, use ice and heat alternating on the ankle until the ankle is repaired, and when it's mostly repaired, then take it easy at first. Walk, then jog, then run in that order, right? That would make sense. And you would say, there's nothing inherently bad about running, but if the ankle's injured, it's not able to take the stress without further injury. I think there's a lot in our diets like that. Now, on that topic, I'm about to play for you about a 1 minute, 18 second, I think, audio. And what this is from a hearing that happened yesterday in the Texas State House where the legislature is considering a law that applies to SNAP payments, which is the basically the modern version of food stamps. But there's a certain level of, even though they're federal, there's also a certain level of state-level control on them as to how they can be used, where they can be used, etc. And what was being proposed in Texas has been proposed elsewhere. I don't believe it's passed anywhere yet. Is that if you're on SNAP, and it's for kids, this is a food stamp program for kids, and you're buying food to feed your kids at taxpayer expense because you don't have enough money otherwise, then maybe you shouldn't be feeding them Dr. Pepper and Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Fritos and Doritos, because those are inherently unhealthy foods. And no, see, people here want to start making these comparisons. Well, no, nobody should be telling anybody what to eat. Hold on, hold on. You're taking my money and you're funding this purchase on the auspice that we need to make sure our children have enough nutrition to be healthy, and then you're allowing a very ill-informed parent to take that money in the form of a SNAP card and go out and buy bags of Doritos and boxes of Twinkies and shit like that to feed their kids with. And I don't care if you believe that kids deserve food like that from time to time. You buy it with whatever money you actually have, then you don't buy it with the government's money. But we could have that debate. But this is what you're about to hear. You're about to hear a woman who is advocating for this law and a gentleman who's advocating against it. The gentleman advocating against it is a representative of the American Heart Association. So basically, they like post haste dispatch their own personal lobbyist down to the state of Texas to defend feeding children sugar under the auspice that there is no direct link between sugar consumption and bad health, which is absolutely patently ridiculous. Anyway, let me play it for you, and I'll come back and give you my thoughts and what this will lead to as a show for next week.
justification to be against this bill.
SB 379 seeks to remove soda, candy, potato and corn chips, and cookies from the list of items eligible for purchase with SNAP.
My name is Alec Puente, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association. I'm here to testify today in opposition to Senate Bill 379.
I would encourage you to look at what it restricts.
The Heart Association is concerned about potential impacts of this bill on participation and population health. Imposing nutritional restrictions will interfere with the primary function of SNAP, reducing hunger, without reducing root causes of chronic disease.
I'm here because I want to support the children on this program and protect them from the chronic disease that sugar will lead them to develop. I actually advocated for this bill in Arizona and was shocked by the big soda company sending their own person to come and advocate for the fact that there's no correlation between soda consumption and obesity, which is just a straight up lie.
So I found it interesting when I shared this on X, one of the people that responded to me said, Jack, correct me if I'm wrong, but back when they wanted to limit the size of sodas in New York City, didn't you say that was government overreach? Yeah, they were limiting the size of a soda that a person could purchase from a private vendor using their own money. So yes, I'm opposed to that. Even though I don't think you should be drinking soda at all, I think it's a terrible, terrible product. I think drinking calories in general is a really bad practice, but I also think that you have a right to do it because I'm not funding it. It's not my money that you're spending on your giant 47,000-ounce soda or whatever. Like, that's your business, not mine, and I don't want the government interfering with it. But in this case, the government's actually the one handing out the money. And they're giving the money to parents who claim not to be able to feed their children, which is bullshit. Because, I mean, literally during the Obama administration, I covered it where the food stamp people were advertising food stamp availability and saying, hey, even if you're making it on your own, even if you don't think you qualify, you should check because maybe you do. Right? So they actually are aggressively attempting to get people onto this. And then there is the whole cabal working into this. I don't believe that any actual doctor anywhere would tell you that it is healthy for children to drink sugary sodas or eat lots of candy or anything like that. And that if a person is literally on assistance financially, to provide food for a child, that assistance should go to empty junk calories like that. I don't believe any doctor, if they're actually being honest and they're not in some compromised position, would tell you that. So why is an organization that represents doctors saying that that's the way it should be? Because this is all part of the giant cabal of the enemies list, right? The real enemies list. Big Food is straight up involved with the American Heart Association, who's telling you, you know, you should eat better. But, you know, don't take away soda from kids using taxpayer-subsidized money. This is disgusting. And for some reason, this one has hit me wrong. This one has made me go into ballistic asshole Jack mode. Because it's like just one more fucking time. They have to just be blunt about the fact that they do not care how many fucking people they kill. And let me be clear about that. That's exactly what we're doing here. Sugar itself is a highly addictive substance. But when you get your sugar by using extravagant chemical processes to extract fructose from corn, and it's even worse than just straight up cane sugar. Way worse. And the cane sugar is bad too. It's not okay if you make your own soda and use cane sugar in it and drink lots of that. You will give yourself diabetes and kill yourself almost as fast. But the fructose stuff, all of the chemical added, all the stuff that's in this is incredibly addictive and toxic. And the food itself is designed by chemists. Chemists do this. Not cooks, not chefs. This is chemistry. And every single big food manufacturer with their sodas, their cakes, their candies, their cookies, their chips, all of it, they are searching for something that they have literally named the bliss point. The bliss point. And that is, you know, when Lay says you can't eat just one, that's what they're talking about. That's why there's sugar in a potato chip. What possible need is there to put sugar on a potato chip? I'll combine junk fats from seed oils with sugar, and a person eats that in a high carbohydrate product like a potato chip, and it triggers an ancestral response to eat more. And you might wonder, why would that be the case if it's bad food, it's toxic food, it's chemical food? Why would it trigger an ancestral response? And it's a very simple explanation for it. In nature, you can find high-fat, high-protein foods. You can find high-carbohydrate foods. You can find high-protein foods. And you can find high-fat foods. What you do not ever find in nature for any extended period of time, even if it's not the same food, just the food being available at the same time, is high-sugar, high-fat, and any significant amount of protein along with those other two. We do not find it. When might you find it? You might find it during a salmon run when there's also lots of berries. And the bear goes out and hogs down on the salmon and hogs down at the berries at the same time, puts lots of fat on. If we are living in a time before Piggly Wiggly's and Albertsons and Kroger's grocery stores where you can't just get food all the time and you go through periods per annum of abundance and shortage and abundance and shortage, and you run through cycles, then you want to use the battery that is fat during the period of abundance to put on more fat than you'd want to carry at all times. And you would store calories in that fat, and you'd store vitamin D in that fat. And when the lean period came, as you burned off the fat, you would draw from the fat reserve, and you would increase your immune resistance with D3, which is a hormone, not a vitamin, as you're drawing from that fat battery at the time when you would most need it. This is how we evolved evolutionarily. Your mind doesn't know. Your biochemistry doesn't know that you now live in a world where you can have that combination at any time you want. And these companies that are doing this have precisely figured out how to fine-tune this response, because if they can get every customer to add 1 ounce of food a week of their food, they make $1 billion that month. That's because it's just how the math works out in an industry the size of food. For those people to co-opt doctors, and I bet this prick that's testifying here isn't even a doctor, and come in as though they represent the doctors, and this pattern repeats. A few years ago, there was a big deal about making things easier on beekeepers in the state of Texas, private beekeepers, small beekeepers. And the lobbyist that came in was from the Texas Beekeepers Association, and he said the beekeepers of Texas do not want this law. Of course, the beekeepers of Texas absolutely did want this law, and the Texas Beekeepers Association is nothing but a phony lobbyist organization that represents Big Honey. See, this just repeats over and over and over again. The people that sell you bee-processed fructose syrup because they fed the bees corn sugar, and then the bees just basically spit the corn sugar back out and made it taste like honey, they don't want competition from the local beekeeper. They don't want competition from the guy with 50 hives. They don't want that. So they call themselves the very thing that they're advocating against. The American Heart Association, if it was concerned about cardiovascular health at all, would never advocate for using taxpayer funds to put high sugar foods into our children. They are scum. That's why they go on the enemies list. So, with that in mind, I'm interested in hearing from you over the weekend. TSPC in the subject line. Who goes on the enemies list? And again, let me be clear. It's not a person. It's not an individual. It has to be at a macro level. Otherwise, we would have a list of like 9 billion people, right? Like, so federal bureaucrats, that will be on the list. I've already made that one decision, right? The federal bureaucracy goes on that list. That covers so much. That covers Anthony Fauci. That covers the government people that are behind the SNAP payments, right? That's the bureaucracy. Big Food, right? That covers all of the shit from Big Food. Big Pharma, all of the shit from Big Pharma. Medical associations, this would include the American Heart Association, the American Diabetes Association, and so many of these other medical, these are medical unions. This is what people don't understand. It might as well be like the IEBW, only they do a lot less harm, right? It might as well be the Teamsters. It's like the Teamsters for doctors of a certain specialty is what these organizations, and as bad as that was, it's worse now. So I want to go through next week and probably the top 10 to 15 macro level biggest enemies of the people. The mainstream media falls into that as well. What is the problem and what is the solution? And the solution is, if it's mainstream media, what is it? You stop trusting anything that they say if you haven't already done so. If Big Food is the problem, you stop eating their products. You want tallow fries? Don't rely on Steak and Shake for them. Go get some potatoes, get a knife, get some tallow, make some tallow fries, put some good salt on them. Do I think you should eat French fries often? No, I really don't think that's the best case scenario, but they do taste good. And if we made our own treats, we'd probably all be a lot healthier. Because no matter how much I've become a believer, because of how much it's worked for me in the Ken Berry approach to diet, I always go back to thinking about the 1970s and the 1980s. I go back to the mid-80s when I was in high school and there was a fat kid in the whole high school. Now, I graduated with, I think, about 400 students. So there were about 1,200 students, you know, 9 to 12, right, freshmen to seniors. There were about 1,200 students at Pottsville High School back then. And there was a fat kid. His name was Jason Kochik. I can still to this day see him in my head. One fat kid out of 1,200 kids. There were a couple that were a little overweight, and specifically there were some girls that were a little bit overweight, you know. But overall, like really fat? Like the people that I'm saying were a little bit overweight, today we would look at a kid like that and not even notice. Honestly, if you look back in history not that long ago, what was considered comically obese is barely seen as heavy today. Or husky today. Like, when I was a kid, like, I was told that I was a little bit husky. And I'm like, why? And it was because I have broad shoulders, and I guess if you know, didn't see me with a shirt off, you didn't know, right? But I'm a Ukrainian. We're built different. We're short and we're stocky, right? We move things. That's what we're tree pushers is what we are. Like, you know where that pop culture reference might be from. But, you know, we're tree pushers. But I wasn't heavy at all. If you took a shirt off, you know, six-pack abs. But so even just a person who was a little bit different in their form, right, then If you're an endomorph instead of an ectomorph, like you were even like, oh, are you putting too much weight on or whatever? And today, like, people that are legit at a level of true obesity are often not seen as that heavy. And there has to be more to it than we eat too many carbohydrates. Sorry, Ken. Sorry, Sean Baker. Sorry to all these guys. And I think they're doing great work. And I love them like brothers, okay? So I'm not putting a negative here. But sorry, it can't be that simple. It can't be that simple. So I want to start exploring more about what we can all do to protect ourselves from our true enemies. And I believe Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, Newsmax, all of it, all the mainstream news, including the ones that claim they're not mainstream, they are your enemy. They lie to you on a daily basis. Fox News said earlier this week that it was about 1,000 Assad loyalists that caused a little dust up in Syria, and at least 10,000 people, most of whom were unarmed civilians, were murdered by the people that we put in power to make Israel happy. Okay, Fox News, you're on the list. I don't care that you're more fair and balanced than CNN. I don't care. That's like saying I'm less of a devil than this devil. You're still scum. The people that are giving you advice on what to eat, from dietitians to the food industry to these medical associations, they are your enemy. Because you're trusting the American Diabetes Association to tell you what to eat, and they're telling you to eat a cranberry oatmeal cookie when you are a type 2 diabetic. They are your enemy. The educational system is your enemy. It's educating your children that you're a horrible person. That's your enemy. You don't send your child to your enemy for an education. And if you do, you better expect them to come back thinking more like your enemy than you. Overall, the majority of the institutions that we trust in America today are our enemies. And just because some of the information that they provide or some of the advice that they give might be beneficial does not mean that even that can be trusted. So I don't think it's simple as do exactly the opposite of what they say. I do think it might be this simple. Do the exact opposite of the things they say the most often and the loudest and the longest. Those things tend to be the worst advice that we would get. And the thing that you probably do need to listen to is their little offhands. They're little, well, of course, you know, you should moderate that, but it's okay, right? Like the first part, the little, like the obligatory thing, that's the part where they're trying to control the lie with a smattering of the truth. So I'd love to hear from you on this subject. I find these people reprehensible that want to feed our children sugar because they know it will help them make their BMW payments. I think it's that simple. With that, I'm going to wrap up. I appreciate you guys tuning in today. Please remember, you can always support our show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. Remember, in just a few hours, 2 hours now, I have the Price Pottinger webinar, and you can find that on the website. You can find it in today's show notes and sign up for it. All you do is fill out a form, and they'll send you a link, and you show up, and it's completely free. I'll be talking about biochar for about 45 minutes, and Nora, who's interviewing me for Price Pottinger, will ask me a few questions, and we'll take questions from the audience for about an hour is what they have planned. So anyway, with that, I will catch you guys next week with a new episode. Tomorrow will be a Friday flashback. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. Hey.